We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In recent years, federal prosecutors have relied on honest services law in their battle against corruption by lobbyists, by corporate officials, and also by politicians. At the same time, critics of this law have said that it's too vague and it's been used too broadly. Supporters and opponents of the law got the chance to argue their positions before the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this month, and now there are many people who wonder about the future of honest services law and also the future of a number of pending corruption cases, including the case involving former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the honest services law, and our guest is Roger Heaton. He is an attorney with the firm of Hinshaw and Culbertson, LLP. His practice focuses on things like white-collar criminal investigations, trials and appeals, also a wide variety of commercial litigation. Before going to work at Hinshaw and Culbertson, he served as U.S. attorney for the Central District of Illinois. So in that capacity, he was the chief federal law enforcement official in the largest geographical judicial district in the state of Illinois. He was also responsible for the formation of the Central Illinois Public Corruption Task Force, a multi-agency investigative and prosecution team that worked in partnership with the FBI, the IRS, the Postal Inspection Service, the Illinois State Police, the Secretary of State's Inspector General's Office. He's talking with us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that people keep their comments brief, so we can keep moving along. But anybody who is listening is certainly welcome to participate. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Heaton, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, we appreciate it, and we think that you maybe can provide some unique perspective to us on this because you're someone who has been on both sides here, both working as a defense attorney and also working as a prosecutor. So that, I think that gives you a bit of a unique perspective.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to talk about it. I'm looking forward to the caller's questions.
Well, just as a way to start out, maybe I could ask you this as a very basic question. What is the idea behind the honest services law?
There's a little bit of history that most people probably need to understand to understand where this recent statute came from. As far back as shortly after the Civil War, we've had statutes in this country that allow federal prosecutors to pursue various kinds of fraud schemes, and they're typically referred to as the mail fraud or the wire fraud statutes. There are variations of those. And under those statutes, anyone who has devised some type of scheme to defraud another can be prosecuted and, if convicted, put in prison or fined substantially. And for many, many years, those statutes were used to prosecute very obvious kinds of fraud schemes, schemes to trick or deceive another person into paying money or giving up property that they ordinarily wouldn't have if they hadn't been defrauded. By the time we got to the Watergate era in this country, prosecutors had determined that there was a way to use those statutes to pursue fraud schemes that sought something besides money or property. For example, a federal employee who was paid some kind of a bribe or given some kind of a benefit to do something that they ordinarily wouldn't have in their job. to give up information that they shouldn't have given up, or to have breached some other kind of ethical provision in the code of conduct for their company or their office. And so prosecutors began using the statute pretty aggressively in the 70s and into the 80s to capture this kind of unethical or dishonest behavior by various kinds of public employees or corporate officials. And everything was seemed to be moving along fine, but there was a case that came to the Supreme Court back in 1987 in which the court said that those kinds of theories of prosecution, theories that prosecuted someone for depriving others of an intangible right, something other than money and property, were not constitutional unless Congress did something to speak more clearly through the mail fraud or wire fraud statutes. So Congress did. The following year, it passed a new statute, which we're going to be talking about a lot today, that is referred to as the Honest Services Statute. And it simply provides that the right to honest services can be the basis for a fraud prosecution. There's no reason, I guess, to go into the details of where that statute can be found in the federal code, but it's very short, and it simply says that a scheme to defraud includes a scheme or artifice to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. Well, after that statute was passed, federal prosecutors went right back into the business of prosecuting people for these kinds of intangible fraud schemes. And unfortunately, the law developed in a way that in different places in the country, the courts interpreted that statute differently. And it got to the point recently where many people were saying that you can't tell in advance, you can't know what the courts are going to do, you don't know what is actually prohibited in one place versus another. And so the Supreme Court has now agreed to hear three cases this year and to make a decision about whether the statute is clear enough, whether it has certain limits that should be applied, or whether the statute is simply unconstitutional and Congress will have to act again if it wants these kinds of schemes to be prosecuted in federal court.
So just to pick up that last point just for a moment before we maybe go back and talk about some other things, if the depending on what the court rules, the Supreme Court, it's possible that they might say that the law can be saved if certain things are done. They may say, we think that this law is simply unconstitutional and just strike it down in whole. It is possible that the Congress then could go back and if they wrote a new law in a way that was specific enough to satisfy the court, then we could have we could still have it, an honest services law, but it would have to be written differently than we have now.
That's exactly right. And there's a lot of common sense in having Congress write laws that are clear enough that people can know in advance whether their conduct would run afoul of it or not. Basic concept of due process in the country is that you should be able to know before you commit certain conduct whether it's prohibited or not. And that's what this whole discussion really boils down to is, do we have a clear enough statute in effect for people to know that it's improper to engage in certain conduct?
Yeah. So just to make sure that I'm clear here, so what the Congress apparently was doing in response to the court, to the Supreme Court, the Congress was saying that it felt that the public had a right to good government and that failing to provide that could be considered a crime. And at the same time, I suppose they would also say that as far as the private sector is concerned, that stockholders and maybe also the public have a right to expect that chief executive officers, people who are running companies, will be honest, will do a good job, will think about the interest of the company more than they think about their own interests. And again, if they fail in that responsibility, that is something that could and should be considered to be a crime. The problem, though, is it seems that the Congress wasn't very clear about very specifically what actions would constitute a violation of your responsibility either as an elected official or as somebody who's running a business.
I think you have that generally correct, David. The legislative history, the statements that were made by members of Congress at the time that they passed this new statute in 1988, essentially said that they wanted the state of the law to go back to what it had been before the Supreme Court made the ruling that it did in 1987. The problem with that legislative history, that kind of explanation of this very short new statute, is that the cases that had been decided in various courts had not been identical. And so what the state of the law was before they passed that statute was not 100% consistent. Mm-hmm. So we all now have to figure out, what does it mean to deprive someone of the intangible right of honest services? Just let me give you a couple of examples, because I think that helps people understand. Suppose a public official, like a mayor of a city, attempted to use the prestige of his office to obtain some kind of special privileges, say something as simple as getting the best restaurant table in a particularly highly popular restaurant without a reservation. Is that depriving the citizens of the community of their right to his honest services? Or say you have a public employee who recommends a friend of his or hers for a public contract, even though that friend was not really competent to execute the contract, without any particular benefit going to the employee who's making the recommendation. Has the public been deprived of its right to the honest services of the employee because that recommendation was made to help a friend? And then perhaps the most famous and somewhat ridiculous example, but one that might be more common than we'd like to hear, suppose you have a salaried employee of a company who phones in sick for the day, even though that employee is not sick, because the employee wants to go to a ball game. That's an example that Justice Scalia used in a dissenting opinion a year ago, advocating that this issue really does need to be addressed by the court. Those three examples, I think, show the limits of this statute are very broad. Yeah. And obviously reasonable people disagree on the scope of the statute. Some federal prosecutors have been very aggressive in using the statute and going after, as you say, good government, and that's what we're facing. That's why the court's taken up these cases.
Well, do you think that it is the case that previously that mail fraud and wire fraud statutes were not enough for prosecutors to go after serious, and I guess there again that one has to ask, well, what do you mean by that? But I'll just say that serious cases of misconduct, either by government officials or by say corporate officials. Did we really need this law?
Well, the statutes are used often, and they are quite effective at classic forms of fraud. You know, most fraud schemes are committed in an effort to get money or property. And most governmental misbehavior that you and I would agree is serious involves bribery or kickbacks of one kind or another. And those are clearly covered, I think, by the mail fraud and wire fraud statutes. So the core of fraudulent schemes, I think, does get captured by the mail fraud or wire fraud statute. But the public has become very concerned about the conduct of many of its public officials, and in the current economic climate, very concerned about the behavior of senior executives in corporations. And so there's a pretty obvious hunger for us to have some enforcement of good government or good corporate governance through the use of a statute like this one. The only question is whether the statute we have is written well enough to provide constitutionally sufficient notice to those who might run afoul of it.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Roger Heaton. He is a former U.S. attorney for the Central District of Illinois. He was the chief federal law enforcement official in what is the largest geographical judicial district in the state of Illinois. Now he is an attorney with a firm of Hinshaw and Culbertson, LLP. in Chicago. And we're talking here about honest services law. This was a law that is a subject of now review by the U.S. Supreme Court. It heard arguments in two different cases earlier this month, and then there'll be another one. Arguments from people who say that the problem with this law is it is too vague, it is too broad, it has been overused, and that some people have argued that, in fact, it should simply be declared unconstitutional. There at least seems to be some inclination on the high court that would tell us that they think that there's at least something wrong with it and that it should be changed, if not struck down completely. And if you have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the cases that have gotten, some of the prosecutions that have gotten a lot of attention that in which this particular law figured prominently, was an important tool for prosecutors.
Sure. I think that's a great idea. Let's start with the cases that are before the court, because I think they provide some of the best examples of what the courts are struggling with. The case that first was approved by the court for consideration involved a legislator in Alaska. His name was Bruce Weirich. Mr. Weirich was an attorney in the state of Alaska, but he also worked as a citizen legislator there. Their legislature only sits for up to 120 days in any calendar year. And while he was serving as a state representative, he approached a particular company for potential employment or work as an attorney. He had decided that he was not going to run for re-election, but before his term expired, he wrote a letter to the chief executive officer of the company and requested to meet with them to talk about whether he could provide legal work for the company in the future. It just so happened that at the same time that he was seeking that employment or that legal work, there was legislation pending before the state legislature that would have had great effect on this company. It was an oil field services company, and the legislation had to do with changing the tax structure with respect to oil field services. And so there was arguably a conflict of interest between Mr. Weirich and his interest as a legislator. He never received any employment by the company. He was never given any money or benefits by the company, but he did not disclose publicly that he was seeking this employment at the same time that he was considering and taking action as a legislator on this tax legislation. And so the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice brought a prosecution against him for breaching his duty, they said, to disclose that conflict of interest. And they did so using the honest services statute that we're talking about today. Well, before the trial could begin, there were some motions filed by the lawyers. Mr. Weirich's lawyers sought to exclude evidence that the government was going to use to help prove that he knew that he had this conflict of interest and that he should have disclosed it. And his lawyers opposed the motion and said all of that evidence would be irrelevant because there was no state statute in Alaska that required him to disclose this conflict of interest. The district court, the trial court in Alaska, decided to exclude the evidence, saying that there was no state duty to do so. And the government appealed that decision to the appellate court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that court reversed the decision of the trial court and said that, in fact, the evidence could be permitted, could be used. And so that question about whether there had to be a state statute, a state duty for what the defendant in the case, what Mr. Weirich had not done, is really at the heart of that particular case before the Supreme Court. There have been other courts that have said a state duty is required as an underlying basis for an honest services prosecution. There have been other courts of appeals, actually more courts of appeals, who've rejected that and said, no, a state duty is not required, and it wouldn't make sense for us to rely on an underlying state duty because if we did, then the law would vary from state to state to state. You'd have some states where somebody could be prosecuted federally for a particular kind of behavior, like Mr. Weirich's, and you'd have other states where he couldn't be. So that's one of the issues that the Supreme Court is going to take up, is whether there is this underlying requirement of a violation of state law.
Mm-hmm. It seems that though the prosecutors there are in a tough spot. I would think that probably most people, when confronted with the facts of the case, would recognize that there was a conflict of interest here. And I think probably many people would say that there are ethical issues here as well. But if the state law does not clearly say you are required to disclose any conflict of interest, then I'm sure that his defense are saying is that you're reaching if you're trying to find some other way, something else you can use against him if the state law doesn't require that he disclose his conflict.
That's exactly what was going on, David, and there was a state law that required him to disclose if he had received more than $1,000 for personal services, but he hadn't. What he hadn't done, of course, was disclose this potential employment that he was pursuing. So while it might be an obvious ethical breach of some kind, the question is whether it's a violation of federal law and should subject someone to potential punishment under the statutes, the federal fraud statutes. And they're pretty severe punishments. I mean, you can receive up to 20 years imprisonment in federal prison and a fine of several hundred thousand dollars if you're convicted of a federal felony. So there's a big difference between breaching that ethical provision and breaching a federal statute.
Hmm. It seems that then in the other cases, the case involving Conrad Black, this was one where the court already heard the arguments, and then the one involving the former CEO of Enron, Jeff Skilling, is scheduled to be heard, I think, sometime next year. There, I suppose the question here goes to what was the intent of the individual, and was the in both of these cases here we're talking about corporations. So it goes to what was the intent of the individual? Was the corporate entity harmed by the act of the individual, and was it the intention of the individual to harm his employer?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Conrad Black was the chairman of the board and the CEO of a company, a publicly held company that owned various newspapers. And his scheme, we won't go into all of the details of it here today for time reasons, but his scheme essentially involved recharacterizing some of the business transactions of that company in a way that he believed would give him a tax benefit in Canada. And he argued that his conduct did not defraud the company that he owed a duty of honest services to as the chairman of the board and as the CEO, since he was alleged to have deprived that company of its right to honest services. He felt like the statute shouldn't be properly applied to him. He took that argument all the way through a trial and was convicted, and the Court of Appeals has affirmed that conviction. But he's arguing to the Supreme Court that this honest services statute has to focus on a deprivation of honest services to the entity for whom that duty is owed. And in the Jeff Skilling case that you referred to, which will be argued March 1st, before the Supreme Court, he had engaged in conduct with some other people at Enron that he argued was designed to keep the stock price of Enron high and increasing. And they engaged in some accounting adjustments that were going to artificially inflate the earnings of the company and therefore keep the stock price high. But he argued that none of his conduct was designed to give him any kind of personal benefit. And without any effort on his part to get a private gain from his conduct, he argued this, the honest services statute should not apply. So what the defendant's intention is, what the results of the defendant's actions are very much in play with the Supreme Court's analysis of this issue.
Mm-hmm. I guess it seems to me also that it goes to a question that perhaps you could ask about, well, some wide varieties of situations in which someone is charged with a crime. And that question is, to what degree do we expect individuals to know right from wrong and to act accordingly without having to go to some law book and look something up to find out whether something is right or wrong.
I think that's right. But again, you know, people have strongly held views about the degree of notice someone should have and about what severity of punishment is appropriate for someone based on the conduct that they've engaged in. We might agree that certain conduct is wrong, including the conduct of calling in sick because you want to go to a baseball game, but we might not agree on whether that should be the basis for a federal felony conviction.
We're at our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll get right to in a moment. Again, I should introduce our guest, Roger Heaton. He's an attorney. He focuses in his practice on things like white-collar criminal investigations. He works with the firm of Hinshaw and Culbertson LLP. They have offices in both Chicago and in Springfield. And his practice area, as I said, includes white-collar crime and commercial litigation. Before going to work there at his current job, he served as the United States Attorney for the Central District of Illinois. He was the chief federal law enforcement official in the district. It's, in fact, the biggest one, largest geographical judicial district in the state. He was also responsible for the formation of the Central Illinois Public Corruption Task Force. That's a multi-agency investigative and prosecution team that worked in partnership with a number of others, including the FBI, the IRS, the Postal Service, Inspection Service, and the State Police. Questions are welcome here. We're talking about honest services law, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I've got a caller up in Piatone, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Great topic, actually. First off, I wanted to make a comment about, the malpractice stuff the stuff that's going on. These legislators figure out a way to get around the system. No matter what you do to change it, it seems like they figure out another way to do it. I've worked for both the federal and the state, local, and I can tell you right now, in some cases, I think the state's worse than the feds, but there's way to to go around the loopholes. They're bought and paid for. I think most citizens out there really believe that the lobbyists own this country. Because you can't tell me if I give you $10 or give a politician $10 versus the guy gives him $10,000, who do you think is going to be answered? Or for that matter, nothing. You know, I think most citizens in this country don't give our politicians money, and I don't think they really care, to be honest with you, because, again, unless you're buying their vote, they're not going to do anything for you. As much as we complain, no matter which side of the fence you're on, we don't get noticed. The other thing is, if you look at Rod Blagojevich, I firmly believe he's going to skate, because Patrick Fitzgerald jumped the gun. From what I've seen in a public eye and what I've read, he has no really, unethical stuff out there outside of verbal stuff. Now, me not seeing what part of the case he has, that's private, I don't know. But, legality, this is a play-to-pay state. And until we get off the play-to-pay, and that's solely the reason why we have so much corruption in the state, is because we allow this to happen until we change it, which, by the way, won't ever change. Because the politicians know that, why would they bite the hand that feeds them? I want your comments on those, and I'll get off.
Well, I don't know to what extent you'd feel that you would be able to say anything specific about the case against Rod Blagojevich, but I did indeed want to at least get into that a little bit, because if the law that we've been talking about here, the honest services law, let us just say that the court decides it's unconstitutional. What does that mean about pending cases like the one against Mr. Blagojevich that indeed might involve using this law?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I appreciate the caller's comments. I think his level of frustration is precisely representative of what we hear from a lot of people out in the country, and the reason why they want to have an effective statute so that we can have clarity and obtain honest governance either from public officials or from corporate executives. But with respect to pending cases, if the court were to determine that the statute could not be used as it has been to the full breadth of all the theories of honest services, then there would be pending cases that would have to be recharged or prosecuted under other theories. Of course, it's not unusual in a federal prosecution for there to be multiple counts of the indictment and other bases for convicting a defendant besides the honest services theory of prosecution. It's often, in fact, used in combination with a mail fraud or a wire fraud charge where there is an allegation of depriving someone or the public of money or property, and it's simply provided as an alternative basis of conviction. So I don't think it's I don't think the sky is falling and that we won't be able to prosecute anyone for mail fraud or wire fraud, but it will change the number of theories that might be available to federal prosecutors. For that matter, there are cases where individuals have been convicted in recent years using an honest services theory, and I suspect that many of them will challenge their convictions, either if they're still serving prison sentences by trying to get released early and continue with that challenge, or at least for those who've already served prison sentences to have the conviction invalidated. So it will create consequences for pending cases and already decided cases if the court knocks the statute out. But keep in mind that the court did that once before in 1987, and the sky didn't fall. Congress went to work and did draft a statute that they tried to use to fix the situation. They may have to do that again. But we have been prosecuting people and those who deserve to be prosecuted for the last 20 years since McNally was decided.
Well, just to go, and again, I want to sort of clarify something and just go back to something that the caller said. If let us do a hypothetical like we like to do in law school. Say I am a public official, and I am in a position to award a contract for some work. You are somebody who is in the contracting business, and you come to me to talk about this. And let us say that you're wearing a wire, and we have this conversation. We meet somewhere, and essentially I say to you, well, I can see to it that you'll get this contract if you will give me some money, X amount of dollars. We shake hands and we go off, and then suddenly now the FBI appears at my door and I'm arrested. Is it clear that what I have done in saying to you that I'll make sure you get the contract if you give me some money under the table, is that clear that that is illegal?
It sounds on the surface like a pretty clear example. Somebody wants money that they wouldn't otherwise be entitled to for exercising some kind of official act. That sounds like a classic case of bribery. But we probably, as lawyers, would want to look into the circumstances of whether you really could make that promise happen, whether that money was given to you, for your personal gain, whether it was something a little blurrier, like you were a little more clever in your statement and you were essentially saying, I'm running for re-election and I need your campaign contributions to continue to do good work for you. And then I might argue as the defendant in that case that, it's part of my job to get campaign contributions so that I can continue to function as a public official. It's also part of my job to pursue legislation or other kinds of controls that I believe are in the best interest of my constituents. So it can get a little blurry, but on the surface of the example you gave, it sounds like a classic bribery.
Mm-hmm. All right, but I guess I appreciate the way that you answered the question, because it says that in the real world, things are never as clear as the hypotheticals we might construct. Depending on many different aspects of the situation, who says what, how they say it, that makes an enormous difference
Sure.
when it comes around to maybe charging somebody with the crime and then having a trial.
Well, and you get into a lot of that with the analysis of these recorded conversations, like the one that you give as an example. Was the person joking? Was the person serious? Was there any other context to the statement? Are there any prior statements where those kinds of statements had a meaning to the two participants in the call, but would have a different meaning to the outsiders. It can get very complicated.
And I suppose it also depends on who initiated this meeting and how this all went down, and can the person say, well, you know, this, it never even entered my mind to do such a thing, but this person lured me into committing a crime maybe I'll not even admit to committing a crime, into doing something that I would not have otherwise done.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, let's talk with some other people here. Urbana is next, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I think I know the answer to these questions, but perhaps just a brief overview or review. I'm assuming that if the court strikes down the law as it stands, that anyone convicted under the current statute, that all that would be expunged and or whatever the proper legal term is, and they would not suffer the consequences of that, and assuming that the legislature then got together and wrote a better law and swiftly passed it, that it wouldn't be retroactive. So in the case of our beloved ex-governor Blagojevich, that any assuming the current law is struck down, any new statute that would be written and passed and so forth wouldn't apply to him. It would be because of ex post facto and so forth. Just a brief review of the consequences of what would happen if the court strikes us down. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for the question. You're correct that we don't allow retroactive application of criminal laws because we want people to have notice in advance of their conduct as to whether it would be illegal. So I don't think you can expect that even if the law is struck down, there will be some new statute passed and applied retroactively to anyone. But keep in mind when you talk about someone who's already been convicted, if this particular statute is invalidated by the court, it's very common in federal prosecutions for there to be multiple counts of conviction. It would be an unusual case where the only basis of conviction was a single count using the honest services statute. And so it gets very complicated to figure out whether the person will walk free, as many people like to think happens when a statute is knocked out. What's more likely to happen is that the person would be brought back for a resentencing, and the sentence would be adjusted to take into account the fact that the honest services conviction is now invalid, but that the remaining counts of conviction are still valid.
Well, I think that probably gets at the question. Let's continue. We'll go to Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I hope this isn't a digression, but these corporate criminals and the government officials they've bought and manipulated, et cetera, and captured, it's just outrageous that this is going down like this. For one, I share some of the sentiment from the earlier caller, another retired government employee, I guess. But is there any movement on whistleblower legislation? It's a bit of a digression, but it seems to me that if there was a better whistleblower law, we'd have more definitive, you know, cases, and maybe some of these corporate looters would have to cop a plea like 90% of the rest of the people that go into the judicial process instead of spending a lot of their ill-gain loot on getting out of jail free. And I guess I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, can you say something about that?
I can offer a couple of comments, and it's a good point. It has become a strong part of our enforcement mechanism in this country to use whistleblower laws to allow private individuals to pursue remedies and instances where the government either cannot or chooses not to get involved. We have both federal and state whistleblower laws in effect that apply here in Illinois, and they are used quite a bit. What the caller seems to be suggesting is that we might even want to expand or increase the powers of whistleblowers, and that's a subject that's worth discussing. I think that's something that goes on in legislative arena and other places as well, and probably should be. We as a society need to decide how much we want to empower people who work within a company or within a government office to disclose certain kinds of misbehavior or fraud and then benefit from having done so. There are some problems that come from empowering whistleblowers, but there are some great benefits as well. So I think he's on to another important part of our enforcement mechanisms that we have to obtain honest behavior from people. It's a sad fact. I think we can all agree that, you know, even though we've been prosecuting these kinds of offenses in both state and federal court for decades, and even though we have increased the penalties to the point where we take away large portions of a person's life if they get convicted, we still find that this type of behavior is ongoing and, if anything, seems more robust than ever.
We have about 12, 13 minutes left in this part of our show, Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest, Roger Heaton. He is an attorney, now in private practice, who works in the area of white-collar crime and commercial litigation. He's a former U.S. attorney for the Central District of Illinois. He was the chief federal law enforcement official for what is the largest geographical district, judicial district in the state of Illinois. And we're talking about honest services law and what it is, and what it was intended by Congress to do, and also the fact that questions have been raised in arguments before the Supreme Court that, in fact, raise some questions about the future of this law and of convictions obtained under it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller clearly is listening to us online. They're calling from San Francisco. I'll go there, line number four. Hello.
Hey, greetings. Yes. Happy solstice. The reason for the season. Hey, you know, I wanted to ask you about the merging of civil and criminal courts. And currently, under the budget crises, there are many attempts in the various states to merge criminal and civil cases. And, you know, it's clearly something that shouldn't happen. I'm wondering, with the old poorhouse laws of Charles Dickens 100 years ago, and all through the South, there was a lot of corruption where a person who owed a debt to an individual could be sentenced in the criminal courts to the poorhouse, an involuntary servitude, and then the sheriffs would essentially be able to rent them out to all sorts of different people. And it was a resurgence of slavery, so to speak. And as I understand it, it was outlawed even before the turn of the century, even though it happened from after the Civil War to when it was finally outlawed. So I'm wondering if there's, with the budget crises, whether there are attempts to reinstate this sort of involuntary servitude. And then I didn't realize that you were also a U.S. District Attorney. I'm wondering why most of the U.S. District Attorneys are not prosecuting these insurance companies and HMOs for fraud. If people are paying their premiums on an honest basis every month, and then all of a sudden they're cut off when they need the help, why are the U.S. District Attorneys not helping prosecute these insurance companies for simple fraud?
Well, that's those questions are way beyond the scope that we set out for the program. I don't know if you want to or can comment on either of those things.
Well, I'll try to make a couple of comments. I'm not sure I can answer fully all of the callers' questions, but first, with respect to the reference to budget crises we have and whether we might see some kind of effort to recreate the equivalent of the old poorhouse laws, I mean, that's an unusual scenario to imagine, since the budget crises seem to be as severe for state government as they are for individuals. I wonder how we would actually effectuate taking state government, which is arguably close to bankrupt, and putting state government to work in the equivalent of a poorhouse to pay off its debts. That's an odd scenario to imagine. With respect to the idea that we've got insurance companies or other companies like an HMO-type program who are engaging in fraud, we certainly have had many corporate executives at insurance companies and other kinds of corporate entities that have been prosecuted using mail and wire fraud theories of prosecution and honest services as well. I think during the course of the Bush administration, when they formed the Corporate Fraud Task Force and started to keep track of the number of prosecutions of corporate executives and public officials, they came up with about 1,300 or 1,400 different prosecutions during the course of just that one administration, and over 200 of those cases were against chief executive officers or the highest level executive in a company. So I think there's been fairly aggressive enforcement against all kinds of corporate executives, including insurance companies. Now, whether we've missed a few as a society, whether we've failed to investigate and prosecute every case, I'm sure we have. But I don't think it's out of any unwillingness to use these statutes against people in any particular industry, including the insurance industry.
Okay. Well, I again want to thank the caller. We have maybe 5-6 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to come back to the honest services law and what's happened here now before the court, as you have explained, there were the court heard two arguments in two cases earlier this month, and there's another that's scheduled for next year that all deal with this. It seemed pretty clear in the run-up to the arguments that at least one of the justices, Mr. Scalia, didn't think too much of this law. And then if you take a look at some of the things that the justices said when the arguments were being made, does that make you think that does it make you think that this law is going down?
That's a really good question. And a lot of people who pay close attention to the Supreme Court and fancy themselves experts at trying to predict the votes of individual justices might be in a better position than I am to make a prediction. But it does seem clear from Justice Scalia's dissent in the Sorich case last term and his questioning of the lawyers in the recent cases that he does appear to believe that the statute is simply hopelessly unclear and that it wouldn't be appropriate as a matter of federal common law, as a matter of federal case law, to define the parameters of the statute, that that's something that Congress alone should do. On the other hand, Justice Stevens, who was on the court back in 1987 when the previous decision was rendered, appears to be satisfied that the case is decided by the courts of appeals, provide sufficient notice as to what falls within the honest services definition. And so it looks to me as though there's not much threat to the statute coming from Justice Stevens. Where the other seven justices are is very difficult to divine from their questions. There certainly were questions that were challenging and pushing back very hard on the idea that we can know or understand all the conduct that's prescribed by the statute, but I would be afraid to predict precisely whether or not the court would completely invalidate the statute or simply try to narrow it and then invite Congress to step in if they think they think that the court has narrowed the statute inappropriately.
Mm.
I would note that there have been one or two cases presented to the Supreme Court since it granted the approval to hear these three cases in which they've denied the cert petition or the request to hear the case. And some people have tried to look at that and draw conclusions about what does that mean. Would they have denied those cases or would they have accepted them and held them if they intended to go one way or another with these cases? There are, as I said, people who spend their entire lives practically focused on the work of the Supreme Court and trying to predict what it will or won't do. What is clear is that we're likely to have this decision by the end of June of next year, and that once we get the decision, everybody's going to benefit from knowing what we can and cannot do.
Is it unusual that the court would do something like this where you have three cases that essentially all deal with the same issues, where you would hear two cases and then sometime later hear another case that's where I would expect the same arguments to be made?
Well, I think it's a little unusual for the court to take three cases that are similar but not the same on a particular topic. I'm not sure whether that is a reflection of whether the court intends to invalidate the statute altogether or not, but I do think that what they've done is they've taken cases in both the public arena, the Weyrich case involving a state legislator, and in the private arena, and the Black and Skilling cases where you have corporate executives involved. So they've put themselves in a position where whatever they do with the statute, they can address its use both in the public and in the private sectors. And they've also taken cases with a broad enough application of the statute that they can address each of the different kinds of theories that the underlying courts have used to cabin or define the scope of the statute.
Is anybody in Congress talking about what would happen if the court should say either you need to rewrite, well, one way or another, I suppose, they're going to say you need to rewrite this if you want this to continue, or would the, in Congress, I suppose they've got enough on their plate so they'd say, well, we'll cross that one when we come to it.
Yeah, I'm sure they are watching closely what the court does. I'm confident there are lawyers on the staffs of the judiciary committees in both the House and the Senate who are well aware of these three cases, and they'll be anxiously watching to see what the court does. I would expect that no legislation would move forward to change or remedy this until the court's decision comes out next spring.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're down to the point where we have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute or so. I guess I would finish up by saying, you know, to someone who is not an attorney, not a prosecutor, not a law professor, what really does this mean? I mean, I guess the question is, for your average citizen, what's the takeaway here?
Well, I think the takeaway for most citizens is a little bit of a lesson in the type of government we have. There's a separation of powers in this country. There's a certain role to be played by the courts, and there's a different role to be played by the Congress. And this is a great lesson in that. Congress has a role in telling us what is and is not permitted, what is prohibited, you know, what the punishments will be if we violate certain criminal statutes. And the courts have a role to ensure that those statutes are clear enough to protect all of us. And to provide guidance for future cases. So I certainly respect and appreciate citizens who care deeply about this subject and who want honest governance either in the corporate setting or in the public setting. But I certainly also respect those who say no matter what the conduct is and how inappropriate or offensive it might be to an individual, it's not appropriate for someone to face a federal felony conviction and imprisonment for something that they couldn't have known in advance was prohibited under federal law.
Mm. Well, we'll have to leave that because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Roger Heaton, he's an attorney with the firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP. They have offices in Springfield and in Chicago. He is also a former U.S. attorney for the Central District of Illinois. And, Mr. Heaton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.
Programs here on WILL are made possible in part by Krennert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit the Promenade Gift Shop for unique gift ideas. More information on upcoming events is at krennertcenter.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. Coming up in just a moment or so, we'll have some news for you from National Public Radio, and then we'll have another hour of Focus 580. And